Perfect way to start our time together this afternoon with a fanfare that Chris himself wrote. His love for music, especially the brass section, cannot be overstated. When I met with him anticipating this day, it was clear that what mattered the most was the music. We are indeed grateful to the Faculty Brass Quintet for their willingness to be here and make it a day to remember Christopher Henry Banner. We gather in the shadow of his death. In the words of Frank Carlton Doane, the death of the body, is it not in the natural order of things in the physical universe? Behold the flowers of the field. They bloom for a brief season and then wither away. The birds of the air, they ascend for their last flight, then descend to fold their wings and find peace in their nest, even the peace of death. So too it is with the beasts of the forest. When their time is come, they seek out some quiet, secluded spot, make their last lair, and lay them down to die. Unafraid and unashamed, what are we that we should think to escape this common destiny of all earthly things or resent this final blow of fate called death? We come today to acknowledge that death has come among us. Christopher Henry Banner died a bit over a month ago. His death did not come completely unexpectedly. For years, he has struggled with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and Parkinson's disease. Until recently, he refused to let them slow him down much, continuing to ride his beloved motorcycle until an accident warned him off, continuing to work on projects, write book reviews, and be all that he could be. It was with great sadness that he closed his shop. Recent months have taken their toll. He was prepared for death. At the same time, he told me in January he intended to always live as if there is a tomorrow, an intent good for all of us to hold on to. We come in solidarity with those who loved Chris most, his wife of 47 years, Betty, his children, Sarah and Eric, with his family. We remember the members of Chris's family of origin who have gone before, his parents, Albert and Dora, his siblings, Alan and Robin. We keep in our hearts and minds his remaining sister, Kay, in Hawaii. We come to commit to the preciousness of memory a life mingled with our own. Those whom we love do indeed leave us, and when we lose them, no spoken words can lessen our grief. But who they were, what they were, will never leave us. He is ours always, interfused with our thoughts and blended with our lives. And so I welcome all of you here today, recognizing that each has unique and special bonds with Chris and his family. Chris was shaped the music community in Manhattan for decades, and these are deep-seated bonds. Let us be honest with death. Let us not pretend that it's less than it is. It is separation. It is sorrow. It is grief. And for Chris, it is an end to a slow but accelerating decline. So let us neither pretend that death is more than it is. It's not annihilation. It can even be relief. Whatever our differing views of the afterlife may be, I am sure that the great abiding love of the universe embraces Chris. He lives on as long as memory endures. His influence continues to be felt. His death is not an end to love. Our love for him does not end, and our need for love from one another is boundless. Death is not an end to joy and laughter, or indeed to music. So our purpose today includes laughter as well as grief, celebration as well as sorrow. We are here to remember Chris and to reflect on his life and what it has to teach us about life and love and mortality. Christopher Henry Banner began his life April 11, 1942, in Seattle, Washington, the oldest of four children. He did not stay there long, though. He was only four when his family moved to Hawaii, a place that left its mark on him, as we can see by all the Hawaiian shirts that are present today. He helped his parents build a house there, discovering some of the influences that would last a lifetime. In Hawaii, he also discovered his affinity for music. He wanted to play baritone horn or clarinet, but ended up with tuba because they needed a tuba player. Chris earned his bachelor's degree in music performance, and he played with the Hawaii Symphony until he decided to move to Chicago to study with the Chicago Symphony. Chris mastered the tuba technically, but he didn't believe he had the artistic ability to continue with performance. What he could do astoundingly well was understand how instruments worked and how to make them work better. And that's getting ahead of the story. In Chicago, he was involved with the Deerfield Unitarian Church, and he worked as a groundskeeper in the country club. And it was in Chicago that Chris had a girlfriend, whose name I don't know, who decided to break up with him. Young people do this all the time. This is the first time I've heard, though, of a girlfriend making a referral. Because when she broke up with him, she said he should get together with Betty. So that's how Chris and Betty met. His ex-girlfriend referred him. And she must have had some good instincts, since their marriage would last 47 years. Now, shortly after, Betty was moving to Manhattan, Kansas, to work at Fort Riley, and Chris wanted to come along, so Betty said they needed to get married. Of course, Chris brought along his tuba and string bass. Coming to Kansas was, in an odd way, a homecoming for him. His great-grandfather is buried in the cemetery in Clifton, Kansas. So he had, in a way, come home. And he made Manhattan his home for the rest of his life. First, Betty and Chris settled into an old schoolhouse 15 miles north of Manhattan with no running water. Chris fixed that, put in a septic system, did so much other work. He always loved projects that he could accomplish with his hands, and he could fix about anything. Each home they've lived in has received new touches from Chris. Now, Betty did comment that through the year they've hung a lot of wallpaper and were still married. And in the current home on Osage, he designed and built an addition. And did you know he has a car in the basement? He built it there. and everything is built so that they can get it out with a crane, so it's fine. Chris's first job in Manhattan was at the country club, and that's where he met Sidney Carlin. But he could not stay away from music. Here in Manhattan, he played in the municipal band for almost 30 years. He brought Tuba Christmas to Manhattan. For 25 years, he gathered 50 or more players on the second Saturday of December at the mall to play carols. What he's most known for in the community, though, may be his repair of instruments. He hadn't been here long when the K-State Music Department realized some of his skills and created a position for him. He took care of all the instruments except the organ, even tuning the pianos. He spent 34 years working for the department, retiring in 2009. Over the years, he invented a gizmo to protect tubas, the Sousa Saver, and they've been sold to bands all over the country. He crafted cherry wood cello stands, a simple and thoughtful design with a place where a bow could be hung. Besides his KSU job, he fixed instruments from all over the community. In the last few weeks, I have heard over and over, he fixed my oboe, my cello, my clarinet, whatever. He could do woodwork, metalwork, any kind of work, really. He built a concrete car and a concrete boat. Who does that? And he found diagnosing and fixing things to be both a physical and mental challenge, he told me. His attention to beauty and utility resulted in many other products, a spice rack, cutting boards, each to its own particular purpose, a clock with geometric balance and curves. He was especially proud of the benches he constructed at the McCain Center, meeting requirements of the fire code. And he told me, every time I see them, I say, those look good. Working with tools to fix and create were so central to him that when he and Betty toured a long-term care facility thinking about future possibilities, he wondered, but where's the workshop? Doing projects not only challenged him, but brought him together with others, including his children and grandchildren. Chris's interests were broad, though. He loved his 1957 BMW motorcycle that went with him through so many transitions in life. He wrote book reviews for the Journal of the West, as well as for the Mercury. He respected tradition and kept things a long time. Did I mention he had a flip phone? When I asked him about his legacy, he said he would live on through his children and hoped that he had treated people decently and fairly. Those values mattered a great deal to him. People were not always easy for him. When he learned relatively late in life that he was on the autism spectrum, it greatly helped him in understanding himself and why he was often uncomfortable in groups that others appreciated. It probably helped others understand him, too, as he was not shy about sharing that about himself, and he helped others with the same diagnosis. The social awkwardness he felt shaped him, but it didn't define him. Many came into relationship with him through shared projects and interests. The people gathered here today, many long-term friends, can testify to his being, yes, a decent and fair man. More than that, a man who made a real difference in the world and was truly unique. That is how we will remember him. Thank you. We will now hear remembrances from Chris's children, Sarah and Eric.
Hello. Thank you all for being here today. Really means a lot to see so many people from so many different aspects of my dad's life and to have our family that could be here. So I just have a couple little stories about my dad. One is that he never, ever wanted me to be the helpless, you know, damsel in distress, and he was going to teach me how to do everything. And he wasn't going to do it for me, no matter what. You know, he made me learn to change a tire. When I lived in Salina, I don't remember if we're putting in a new garbage disposal or replacing a garbage disposal. But like most home improvement projects, it involved multiple trips to the hardware store. Unfortunately, the hardware store closed, so we couldn't get the last piece that we needed. So he and my mom went home, and a few days later, we used Google Video Chat and set the computer in the kitchen floor and aimed it under the sink so that he could see what was going on. And he guided me through putting in the rest of the garbage disposal. Another time I had asked him for help changing my windshield wipers, which I knew how to do and, in fact, had taught my best friend how to do. However, shortly before this time, I had tripped while I was running and I had broken my finger and really had very limited mobility in it. And I was like, Dad, will you help me change my windshield wipers? And he's like, well, I'll do one and show you how to do it. And I was like, no, I know how to do it. I just literally can't do it right now. So then he gave it and did it for me. But that was the only time. And then one of my other favorite stories of my dad is when my parents lived out on Browning Avenue, we had a garage door clicker. And my dad and I went out for ice cream one night, and we were talking about garage door openers, and in theory, there's got to be another garage somewhere in the world that uses the same frequency. So as we're driving home down Browning Avenue, we're clicking at every garage door. We're like, nope, that one didn't open. Nope. Nope. Oh, hey, look, that one opened. And then we had to make a U-turn and come back home. So, but it was just, you know, it was silliness in his own way. You know, how many people drive down the street trying everybody's garage door? So, those are just a few of my favorite stories of my dad.
Yeah, all of that. And as Sarah said, it's deeply humbling to look out and to see all of you. That means a lot. And thank you. He had asked Sarah and I to speak this afternoon. Actually, the truth of the matter is, one day he called me up and asked me to lead the entire service. He believed so strongly in me. I was caught off guard, as I often was when he said something that you weren't expecting. And I told him rather more pointedly than I really intended and later apologized for that he had his own minister. And I would rather be his son. And I sat down to write. Last month, this month, last week, this morning, trying desperately to figure out how to make what needed to be said smaller. when talking about such a big man. Ever since he died last month, I've had people asking me, who had only met him in passing or had never met him at all, they've been asking me about him, who he was. And I've never quite figured out how to answer the question, because one of the things that he valued deeply in life was honesty. And I think that the honest truth is that what can be said about any of us is that we're complicated. Him no less than me. And there's never enough time. There's never enough time. Not enough time to tell the whole story. Never enough time to capture all of the nuance. Never enough time. To say, I love you one last time. If that's the sort of thing that you do. I loved my father, and I know that he loved me, but I also know that every single phone call we had over the last 20 years ended the same way. I love you, I'd say to him. And he'd say, okay. Is there anything else we need to talk about? I don't think so, I'd respond. I'll talk to you later, he'd say. It was a technique he had learned, right? He had been taught. He was good at these things that he could learn, he could implement the form and the structure of things. Once someone had told him what they were. Not long ago, my mom told me about that day so many years ago when Emily and I set off into the world. They had planned a party to send us away at their house, and parties were not my dad's forte. But there it was, a party, a going away party in the backyard, and there my dad was again in that strange place of knowing he needed to be around, but not really knowing what it was he needed to do. And my mom, by this point, 40 some years in, had figured out the answer. She said, Chris, this afternoon, just do everything I tell you to do. And he did. He knew how to be a man of his own, and he also knew that sometimes you had to play your part in the piece. The band was made of many players. To fulfill your place in the order of things. And so he did that, as long as he knew that there was someone who could help him tell him what his place was. I say it's complicated because of all of the conversations I had over the years with my dad, over his own dad, who was, I think, it is only fair to say, was an abiding disappointment to him. His father had made a successful career as a professor at the University of Hawaii, and he had made it clear to his children, all four of them, from an early age, that success in life looked like but one thing: to become a professor at a university. It was a standard to which he thought success could be judged, and it was a standard that none of his children or his grandchildren made. There was pain and sorrow that echoed in his life from the ways that he carried his father's expectations with him that will always sadden me. Because I think that my father fell into the trap that so many of us do in our life. Judging ourselves by standards that are not our own, built around the things that others imagined rather than what we were actually called to do. The kind of judgment that comes from telling a horse that it is a failure because it cannot fly like a condor, and never seeing it running down the field. I say it's complicated because no matter how much we told him that we loved him for who he was, just as he loved us for who we were, those ghosts of his childhood never quite faded away. He was a bright and capable man, a good man who left the world a better place for his living in it. But it was so, so hard for him to own that for himself. And yet he was also so much more, a man who believed deeply in both work and work well done. I can't tell you also how many times he shared his frustration with the emphasis on a STEM education without a concurrent understanding of the place of arts as vehicles for communication and connection. He was the kind of man you might have called a Renaissance man in another era. Not confined to one narrow band of knowledge, but also not one who thought that his work or anyone else's was for others alone. It was because of him and what he taught us, the values he lived out, that when I was ordained to Unitarian Universalist ministry, I asked for a reading from Marge Piercy to be part of the service. You might recognize the words, to be of use. It ends with these words, "The work of the world is common as mud. Botched, it smears the hands. But the thing worth doing, well done, has a shape that satisfies. Clean and evident, Greek amphoras for wine or oil, Hopi vases that held corn, are put in museums, but you know they were made to be used. The pitcher cries for water to carry, and the person for work that is real. Our lives are filled with the work of his hands, the spice racks and cabinets and bookshelves, the mousetrap cars, and the houses that shine from the floors up, the floors he finished himself. The stained glass he learned to make in retirement so that that old dame of a home, 150 years old, would just sparkle a little more. And as my sister said, he didn't just want to do it for you, or at least not for us. He wanted to make sure his children and grandchildren knew how to navigate in the world, whether that meant changing a tire or changing oil or hanging sheetrock or bucking 80-pound bundles of shingles up two-story ladders. Because I tell you, it is the honest truth that when my parents had a small addition put onto their garage just a year or two ago, it was the first time in more than half a century that anyone in our family paid a roofer to put a shingle down on a building we owned. Which meant, of course, that he had tools, and lots of them. He loved to tell the story of my mom coming home with a client who had had a husband or boyfriend, I quite forget which, who had gone out, this in the early 70s, and spent an inordinate amount of money on tools. At least $70. This in a month in which, if I remember the story right, he had spent something in the order of $2,000 on tools of his own. Tools that took tending and care, and that he wanted you to know how to tend and care for properly. He wanted to make sure you knew how to properly coil a cable, as every sound man in the room will testify to. He wanted to know that you knew the right way to sharpen a knife on the whetstone, the right way to drain the air compressor when you were done so it wouldn't rust from the inside out. Which is why it was not a surprise to me that in his final days he made arrangements to sell the tools at his shop when he knew he could no longer use them. The dent removal tools, the hammers, the clamps, the pads for the saxophones and clarinets of every shape and size. We told him, we said, "Dad," my mom said, "Chris, if you don't want to do it, we'll take care of it for you when you're gone." But he knew that we did not know how to use those tools, or what they were worth, or who would need them. And so he found the band instrument repair journal advertising section and put out an advertisement, making sure that they would be sold not willy-nilly. He wanted those tools to be of use. He wanted them to keep the horns and the woodwinds and the strings playing in the hands of children and adults for many years to come. And so he put that advertisement out and arranged with a full 7-page long itemized invoice, item by item, of what it was and what it was worth, and made an arrangement with a gentleman from Louisiana who was just starting out with his own shop to buy them all. As it turned out, 4 days after my dad fell. He wanted those tools to be at work. There was work to do to make the world a better place, to keep things beautiful in sight and sound. It is always a dance between the things that he could do and wanted to do to make the world better, for work that is real, wanting to make sure that we could do it too. Unless, of course, we couldn't. Some of you will know that last winter we celebrated Christmas in the hospital in Kansas City. He had been in the ICU and then transferred to KU, and he was there for more than a week. But String Fling was coming in January, and he was sure that he needed to be there. And so even though he was still recovering, it mattered to him that those kids who came to this place to create music had someone who had the tools and the knowledge and the resources to make sure they could keep playing no matter what happened that day. Even though it had been years since he'd formally retired from the music department, he wanted us to navigate the world and to have the tools to do it. And then there's this other thing I need to be said about this man, Christopher Banner, our father. He not only wanted us to have the tools, he wanted us to know that he believed in us. Beyond all measure of reason. He was never one to let the common expectation get in the way of what he believed his children or his wife could do. I've come to ask my mom a number of times over the years about the story of how and why they got together. I think most of us as adult children eventually come to that question. We look at our own lives, our own children, our own spouses, and marvel at all of the twists of fate, the turns of chance that have brought us to this place. And I don't know about you, but I, in my less than great days, look at myself and wonder and marvel that anyone would choose me. And so I asked her. And what she said to me again and again is that this man believed in her. He believed in people in ways that we couldn't even see for ourselves, with words we didn't even have. But he did. He believed in the possibilities of those around him, his ability to decide to do something new and to do it, to build that concrete boat that floated all the way to Panama, and then the concrete car, and then to work on that car that sits now forlornly in my mother's basement, as if waiting for just one more wiring diagram, one more twist of the wrench, one more body panel waiting to be formed. He believed in things beyond all measure of reason. Like that time, some of you who are local will remember, a few years back when the city had built the new bridge over the river into town, left the old Art Deco piers from the old viaduct. And there were years this town spent trying to decide what to do with them. And there he was, pondering this very question, and he decided that it was his place to address the problem. And so he decided that it would be a good chance to do a little civic education, a little bit of local history, and over in his shop he set up a little arrangement where he could build a silhouette of the steamship Hartford, which had run aground here in the early 1860s when this town was New Boston, the passengers intending to go all the way to Junction City, but stuck here and agreeing to stay, as he had learned and taught me, as long as the town changed the name to Manhattan. He built that silhouette, and then, in an act of radical civic beautification and education, he called me to help install it one stormy night. Without a permit or a conversation with anyone else. And so there we found ourselves on a pair of ladders, because why have one tool when you can have two? There we found ourselves on that pair of ladders with that small pickup truck and a whole lot of pluck. And any reasonable person would have told you it wouldn't work, and it didn't. We barely made it off those ladders without falling to our own doom. But that was the kind of man he was. The kind who had ideas and then made them real. Or at least tried to. He believed in the people around him, and it is because of that fact. It is because of that fact that I am the man that I am today. The reason that we are the family that we are today, all of us living in old houses that we take care of because we never believed we couldn't, helping and serving ones beyond our small circles of hearth and home, and making the world a beautiful place his steady guiding hand with us always. His voice of encouragement and belief in what was possible, even when no one else could see it. Even now, and always in the days to come. We'll miss you, Dad. And no, there's nothing else we need to talk about. I'll call you soon.
Invite Chris's longtime friend Paffy to speak, followed by an even longer time friend, David Traub.
I am a former Unitarian who defected to the Congregational Church, and now my son refers to me as a Seventh-day absentist. I met Chris Banner in 1971 at the Unitarian Fellowship when it was down on Bluemont. And I remember thinking that he was an interesting person, a unique person. Over time, he and I became good friends. Excuse me. In terms of personality, we were very different. But we had similar interests. In our spare time, we both liked to build things. I built a workshop. Chris converted a garage to a workshop for his musical instruments, for repairs. Most of my projects involved some sort of carpentry, but most of Chris's projects were much less ordinary, like building a concrete car, for heaven's sakes. We had a brief attempt at a joint venture. I had a printing press that I had purchased in North Carolina one summer and moved to my home in Tulsa and when I was in college, and then when I moved here, I left it there, but my parents asked me to get rid of that thing out of their garage. So I convinced Chris to let me keep it in one of the bays of his garage next to his workshop. A few years after that, Chris discovered that KSU was selling a Linotype typesetter, a big, humongous, that was about a ton, literally. Chris and I decided we would buy that. So Chris went to the auction and won the bid for the Linotype. But our plans got foiled because when the forklift that was being used to transport the Linotype to it dropped it and broke the frame of it, so they gave us our money back and an apology. In hindsight, we were probably better off without the Linotype, and we should have given them thanks instead of asking for an apology. In any event, Chris and I used to do lots of things together. Until his health failed, we used to go canoeing, and we would go canoeing in January occasionally. And we took one of those winter trips down the Kansas River one, I believe it was in January. We planned to put in at Stag Hill Golf Course and take out at the bridge. And we had carefully checked the put-in point and the take-out point to make sure that ice wouldn't be a problem. And we started out, and we invited two other guys to go with us, one of them being my son-in-law. What we had not counted on was encountering an iceberg in the river. We've been about two-thirds of the way along the trip, went around the bend, and found that the entire river had iced over at one point. And never being timid about such things, Chris decided maybe we could walk across the ice and take the canoe and put it on the other side. We couldn't. We found out by Chris ending up knee-deep in the Kansas River in January. Needless to say, that ended our canoe trip. We had to stash our canoes and hike up to the road, and fortunately had a cell phone with him, and we were able to reach Betty, who came out and rescued us, and Chris didn't get frostbite. But Chris and I helped one another with various projects over time, roofing, construction. He, at one time, painted a shingle for me that said, Patrick Caffey, attorney and roofer. In the past few years, of course, as Chris's health was failing, we spent most of our time together having lunch and talking about our families and what was going on in the world. Time passes, you know. I believe that my life has been enriched by my friendship with Chris, and I'll miss having lunch with him.
Hello, I'm David Traub. I'm originally from Louisville, Kentucky, but I went to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania to study at the University of Pennsylvania, where I got a master's degree in architecture, and I've stayed in Philadelphia my whole adult life. I just came in yesterday into Kansas City, then over here. Anyway, I'd finished my degree there, and I got married to a woman that I met at university. And then I started working in several architectural firms for a year or two. And the Vietnam War was raging then. This was 1965, 66. And that draft board back in Louisville, Kentucky, got a hold of me and put me in the Army. oh, my goodness, that was something. I already was living with my wife, had a beautiful home. They sent me to Fort Gordon, Georgia, for basic training, and then I got notice that I was going to be put into a special program for professionals, for architects and engineers. I guess the Army made a mistake and put me where I should have been. And so I further got notice that I was going to be sent to Honolulu, Hawaii, to work in the Corps of Engineers, the district office of the Corps of Engineers in Honolulu. Also, you need to know that I am a cellist. I play the cello. I studied from childhood. I might have become a professional cellist, but I went into architecture. And when I got out to Hawaii, I was able to live off base in my own apartment. I had my own little car, and I had kind of a 9-to-5 job with the Corps of Engineers, and so I had time, and I got a job at night and weekends playing for the Honolulu Symphony. So this is 1966, so that's where I met Chris Banner. Okay, I don't know exactly what the nature of the first encounter was, but we got to know each other. So I guess we have sympathies and affinities that somehow brought us together. We both play bass instruments. I guess the tuba and the bass fiddle would be closest, or the trombone and cello would be close. But we were down there with the bass clef, okay? We got to know each other gradually, as friendships will evolve. Some of my memories are as follows. After the rehearsals of the Honolulu Symphony, we would get together and go to these little Japanese bars down on the waterfront in Honolulu. Okay, and we would sit there and have the most intimate conversations, and it was really heart to heart. Chris did tell me about his relationship with his father, and that he felt he might be disappointing him in the fact that he wasn't going to become a professor. I think that he's really done much better. I hope I'm not offending any professors in this audience. I'm sure there are some big university town. But anyway, in his own way, he did just as well or better than being a professor. And regardless, that was his personal destiny. So we would have these little tete-a-tetes down in these bars. From time to time, these beautiful Japanese women, scantily clad, would come and sit down with us and chat. They meant no further harm than to get us to have more beers, so be a beer sure there. The most memorable occasion in Hawaii in connection with Chris was one weekend when I was invited with him to go out to the home of a distinguished anthropologist, Gregory Bateson, a man who's kind of forgotten today, perhaps. He had one time been married to Margaret Mead, and he also was a friend of his colleague at the university, Dr. Banner, Chris's father. I forget what his first name is, but anyway, we had the Batesons with his then wife were out of town somewhere, so we were invited out to their beautiful home on Kaneohe Bay, which is across Oahu from Honolulu. This moonlit night in the sea, and it was just Chris and I were together for the whole weekend, talking and eating and a little drinking maybe, and that was such an intimate moment of being together in such a beautiful place. Incidentally, I didn't say that, I left Philadelphia, went out to Hawaii. I was all by myself. My wife couldn't join me because she had already gotten a job in Philadelphia. And I think as many soldiers, servicemen experience, and women, can be lonely, away from home in the service. Fortunately, I didn't go to Vietnam. I was defending the beaches of Waikiki from an invasion, but we had pretty good duty. But nevertheless, it can be lonely being in the service when you're away from home, and I didn't have any friends yet in Honolulu. And so Chris offered me a great deal of friendship, which I'm grateful for. I only regret that I unable to return enough to him because I lived so far away. Although I did see him in Chicago on one occasion, and he came to Philadelphia on another, and we've been in constant touch on the phone and writing. Okay, one little anecdote is that when Chris was living in Chicago, my brother and his wife, my brother Charles and his wife Mary, were there at the same time. Charles was teaching in a school there. He's a photographer now. And Chris had his concrete boat at that time out on Lake Michigan, okay? And he invited my brother and his wife to go out for a little bit for a sail. I don't know, it wasn't a sailboat, was it? It had a motor. And my brother often recounts this. But anyway, they went out in Lake Michigan in this concrete boat. And everything was fine, except that it started to rain, and it was a cold night out there. And so notwithstanding the rain, the boat did very, very well. A bit of genius, and Chris was so inventive. And the boat did get back to shore, obviously. That's many years ago, and my brother is quite well to this day. So, yes, there is love. And that's okay. but there is friendship, and that's so very important in this world where we can be isolated and kind of cast into kind of being by ourselves. And Chris, over the years, offered me a great deal of friendship. And Chris, I'm very grateful to you for that. Thank you. Thank you.
Finally, Craig Parker will offer reflections from himself and from Jack Flower.
Jack Flower is unable to be here today due to prior commitment, so he asked me to read his tribute first. So every time I say I, it's really Jack. I've had the privilege to know Chris Banner as a valued colleague and a good friend for nearly 50 years. Our connection began when, as the K-State faculty member assigned to oversee the activities of the wind percussion area of the Department of Music, I became aware that an important aspect of that responsibility was to ensure that all of the equipment critical to the functioning of this area was maintained at all times. This equipment not only included the various instruments of the bands and orchestras, each with its own unique technical properties, but the supporting devices as well. The department relied on recording and playback equipment, pianos, microphones, and later computers, printers, etc., to fulfill its mission to educate the students. In the BC, or before Chris era, the repair and maintenance of all this equipment was divided between an army of specialists, piano technicians who were contracted to tune and maintain 100 pianos spread around the department, organ specialists who would have come from all over the country to maintain and service the half dozen pipe organs, as well as many other areas of specialization. However, these aforementioned maintenance items were dwarfed by the repair and maintenance of the hundreds of string, wind, and percussion instruments that were used every day by bands, orchestras, and classes. These repairs and maintenance were handled in an extremely inefficient manner, which necessitated having many duplicate instruments in the inventory. I don't recall the specific details, but soon after Chris arrived in Manhattan and opened his instrument repair shop, he became the go-to man for the Department of Music. Students would take their instruments to him, then the conductors of the various ensembles began to call him in for emergency instrument repairs. At some point, someone discovered that Chris could tune and perform repairs on keyboard instruments and electronic equipment. Before long, it seemed that Chris was spending more time in McCain than he was in his own shop. As a matter of fact, he was given space in McCain to set up some of his own equipment. Things had quickly accelerated to the point that if anyone had a problem with any kind of equipment, they were told to go see Chris. He'll take care of it. Remuneration for all this effort was taken from a variety of sources, and often no remuneration was available. Finally, I was able to convince my superiors of the importance of what Chris was doing for KSU and the Department of Music, and through the creative efforts of Shirley Olson in the Office of the Dean of Arts and Sciences, a new position, that being musical instrument repair specialist, was created, and Chris became a salaried employee. The thing I found most interesting about Chris's approach to life was how, when a "I wonder how" moment came to him, instead of mulling it over for a few moments and then moving on to something else, as most of us do, Chris would tackle it as, "How can I make it come to fruition?" Although I do not recall having thought to myself, "I wonder if I could build a concrete car," Chris obviously had that thought and proceeded to build a concrete car or build a bass violin from scratch, or when he decided to construct a custom truck in the basement of his home, designed and constructed an addition to the basement with a movable roof for access and egress. Those of us who have regularly read the Sunday edition of the Manhattan Mercury have, for the past few years, been treated to Chris's wonderful book reviews on an amazing selection of subjects, from nature to history to politics or any other topic that drew his attention. It is interesting that he hardly ever reviewed books on the arts, his primary field. This is simply another example of Chris Banner's quest for knowledge. Thank you, Chris Banner, for allowing me to call such a remarkable person my friend. I'm going to miss you. Okay, now this is me. One of the joys of my youth was to peruse my grandmother's issues of Reader's Digest and devour the monthly feature, "The Most Unforgettable Character I Ever Met." In reading this column, I learned much about athletes, entertainers, journalists, and captains of industry, as well as those of more local impact. However, none of these characters ever built a concrete boat or were as intriguing as my most unforgettable character, Christopher Henry Banner. Professional musician, instrument repairman, piano tuner, composer, author, inventor, mechanic, loving husband, father, and grandfather, all-around great guy and my friend. I first met Chris in August of 1982 when I replaced Dr. Chapel White, then on leave of absence, as the major professor for Chris's master's thesis. Chris's insatiable curiosity and brilliant mind led him to examine thousands of pages of old newspapers, interview countless participants, consult virtually every available book and dissertation on the history of American band music, and compile detailed repertoire and personnel lists for the Manhattan Municipal Band for that group's first 60 years. The result of his indefatigable research was his 357-page master's thesis titled The Manhattan Municipal Band, 1920 to 1980, An Ethnographic History. This volume not only details the story of one of Manhattan's cultural assets, but examines the changing role of the town band in American society. Even 36 years later, this thesis still ranks as one of the finest ever produced by a KSU student. It is readily available on the KSU Library website. Go read it today. Speaking from an admittedly biased perspective, I find that thesis much more interesting than Chris's second master's thesis, this time in geography, completed in 1997. It was titled Evaluation and Prediction of Wheat Leaf Rust Severity and Prediction of Yield Components of Rusted Wheat Through Use of Aerial Color Infrared Photography, unquote. Read that one, too. Chris and I spent countless hours together over the years, commuting across central Kansas to play with the Heart of America concert band, in his repair shop as he fixed my trumpets and my daughter's French horns, and lunching at some of Manhattan's elite dining establishments such as Jimmy John's, McAllister's, Mr. Goodsense, Subway, and our favorite, Dairy Queen. Chris often shared the results of his wide-ranging curiosity by sending me advanced copies of his dozens of book reviews on topics ranging from Thomas Jefferson's America to feminist saints to Vladimir Lenin to foods of New Mexico to psychological profiles of the current occupant of the White House and Mar-a-Lago Resort. Chris also broadened my knowledge by forwarding periodical articles that he found of great interest. He alerted me to the annual winners of the Ig Nobel Prizes for research that makes people laugh and then think. Among these were research topics that covered and proved riding roller coasters can help one pass kidney stones. Playing the didgeridoo helps relieve sleep apnea, and that old men do have big ears. Without Chris, I would not have known that the world's largest piano at 18 feet, 8 inches long was in Dunedin, New Zealand, or that the encephalophone was an instrument that you could play with your mind just by thinking, or, most importantly, that Swiss scientists had subjected 9 22-pound wheels of cheese to endless 24-hour loops of one song each, transmitted directly into the cheese wheels. The results of this experiment showed that Mozart's magic flute produced the mellowest taste, while of all the cheeses, hip-hop enhanced cheese had the most potent aroma and the strongest flavor. If Chris's basement did not already contain a 90-year-old car that he was rebuilding, I would wager that he would have tried to replicate the cheese experiment. Chris and I seemed to be in competition to see who could make the most trips to the emergency room, me with my noon-hour basketball injuries and Chris a result of bike accidents. I fear for the financial stability of Ascension Via Christi Hospital now that I've retired from the hardwood and Chris has gone to that great bike path in the sky. Chris, you enriched my friend and the lives of countless others who knew you. I doubt that anyone will ever dethrone you as the most unforgettable character I ever met. Thank you.
So we say farewell to Christopher Henry Banner. He leaves, his absence leaves our lives with a little less melody, with a little less useful skills, with a little less broad interests, all these things that he gave to us. I leave you with the words of Carl Sandburg. Gather the stars if you wish it so. Gather the songs and keep them. Gather the faces. Gather for keeping years and years, and then loosen your hands. Let go and say goodbye. Let the stars and songs go. Let the faces and years go. Loosen your hands and say goodbye. To close our service, we will sing together, Let It Be a Dance. The words will appear on the screen. Good times and the bad times too. Join the family in the Alsop room down the hallway to the left as you exit for refreshments and conversation.
Thank you.